From WBUR Boston, I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A major part of President Obama's signature health care law includes the expansion of Medicaid, the government-run health insurance program for the poor. Millions of people are already enrolled, and their number is expected to jump by many more millions when the rolls are expanded. But conservative lawmakers in the states are pushing back. There's just no money for it, they say, and they're not going to do it, period. This hour on Point, the coming brawl over expanding Medicaid. You can join the conversation. Do you receive Medicaid benefits? Does it work for you? You can comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now is Noam Levy, the national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. You can find a link to his most recent article on the battle over Medicaid at our website, onpointradio.org. Noam, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Wade.
Most states are embracing the expansion of Medicaid that will insure millions of uninsured poor people, but not all. As many as 10 Republican governors are balking.
That's right. There's quite a lot of resistance to the Medicaid expansion, particularly among conservatives in some very important states such as Florida and Texas.
Is this about cost or political ideology or both or something else?
Probably a little bit of both. There's certainly a lot of ideology. Medicaid has never been a program that's been embraced by conservatives the way it has by liberals. It's a classic government-run safety net program, and Republicans have been trying for decades to scale it back or to change it. There was a push 20 years ago when Newt Gingrich was speaker to scale back the program. But there are some cost issues as well. The way that the law structures the expansion, it changes the way that Medicaid has worked over the last half century. Traditionally, Medicaid was a split between state and federal governments in terms of who picks up the tab. The new law envisions that the federal government will pick up the lion's share, 100% of the cost of expanding the program for the first few years, dropping down to about 90%. But that still means that states would have to pick up a small increment of the cost. And if you're in a state that's struggling to balance your budget, as most states are right now, being offered a $2 million house and being told you have to pay $100,000 might be difficult.
I know that many conservatives and conservative governors and lawmakers did not expect to have to go down this road. They thought the Supreme Court was going to find the Affordable Health Care Act unconstitutional. And so is this a reaction to the Supreme Court's ruling that now they will take up the torch and try to advance it?
I think there is a little bit of that. There certainly was a great expectation on the right that after the oral arguments this spring that the court was going to strike this down. There was a huge amount of disappointment that didn't happen. I think it's really important not to understate the hostility that this law still generates among conservatives around the country. It's in many ways unprecedented that a law that's now been on the books for almost 2.5 years continues to engender so much partisan division. So there really has been very little diminishment in the intensity of the opposition to this law since it was signed in 2010. So some governors are putting their hopes, I think, now and stopping what they can at the state level, and many are now saying, even if they're not ready to commit to not expanding Medicaid, they're saying we're not going to do anything until November, hoping that Mitt Romney will stop the law.
Last week, the New England Journal of Medicine published a study that residents of states that have expanded Medicaid coverage will likely live longer, they'll be healthier while they live longer, and they'll have better access to medical care. To me, this doesn't seem to be a revelation, but I guess this question and the answers are not as straightforward as I might imagine.
Well, there's been a lot of debate and sort of health wonkery about sort of what the impact of having health insurance and Medicaid specifically is on health. And there have been some studies over the years that have cast doubt on how well Medicaid provides for people. This study, as well as another one in Oregon that was a blind study comparing two populations, one that got Medicaid and one that didn't, seemed to indicate what what would seem to be common sense, that if you have health protections, you're probably going to be healthier. But the important point here is that Medicaid, though it provides a safety net to mainly to children, to disabled people, to seniors now, and ultimately to all poor people, is not a program that even supporters of the program say works as well as it could. It's very difficult to provide care to this population. It's a very vulnerable population. Disabled and seniors who are on the program are typically very expensive to care for, so it's difficult. But there's a widespread belief on the left and I think on the right among those who don't want to just eliminate the program that it could be a lot better, that state and federal leaders ought to be doing more to think about how to provide health care to this needy population in a way that ensures better care and ultimately making the program more sustainable in the long run.
How does it need to be better, and is there anything in the Affordable Health Care Act that makes it better?
There are a number of initiatives in the new law that are designed to do that. One of the persistent problems with Medicaid has been a subset of the population that is covered. So there are about 50 to 55 million people at any one time that are on Medicaid right now. About half of those people are children. And children are typically not as expensive to cover. They're typically healthier. But about a quarter of the people who are on Medicaid right now are either elderly or disabled. People might say, well, I thought elderly people are on Medicare. Well, they are on Medicare, but if you have a low income and you're over 65, you qualify for both government programs, Medicare and Medicaid. This population and the disabled population consume more than two-thirds of all of the money that Medicaid spends every year, more than $400 billion. And to date, the effort to coordinate care for this population, to make sure these people are getting to the doctor when they need to, that they're taking the drugs that they're supposed to, that they're getting the tests that they need, has been lacking around the country. So there's a number of efforts in the new law designed to better coordinate care for this extremely needy population, 15-20 million people. And many people believe if you do that, you can help control the costs. And it's, as any state-federal partnership in government is, it's complicated because you have state interests, you have federal interests. There's always a give and take between federal bureaucracies and state leaders. State leaders always want more control. Federal bureaucracies typically want to make sure that basic standards are being met. So it's complicated to do this. But I think there's a general recognition that if the states and the federal government can work together better to try to streamline the care for these extremely needy people, seniors mainly and disabled people, that there may be a way to make this program work better.
Noam Levy, national health care reporter for the Los Angeles Times, thanks for the excellent overview today.
Thank you.
Conservative governors, including Nikki Haley in South Carolina and Rick Scott in Florida, say their states won't expand their Medicaid programs. Here's Texas Governor Rick Perry speaking on Fox News on Monday, explaining why his state also will reject federal funding to expand Medicaid.
The bottom line here is that Medicaid is a failed program. To expand this program is not unlike adding 1,000 people to the Titanic. You're going to further drive this country into debt.
Governor Perry said he would not be, quote, party to socializing health care and bankrupting my state. Texas has the highest percentage of uninsured people in the nation, and the expansion of Medicaid would cost the state about $1.3 billion through fiscal year 2017. I'd like to bring John Otto into the conversation. He represents the 18th District in the Texas State House of Representatives. Representative Otto, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Wade.
We're talking about this expansion. Representative Governor Perry describes Medicaid as a failed socialist program. Do you agree?
It's a failed program. I don't know whether, you know, define what socialist means, but I do believe it's a failed program, yes.
You know, let's talk about why not expand Medicaid to cover the poor, given Texas has so many uninsured people without health insurance.
Well, the real issue for me in all of this is there was an article in the Houston Chronicle 2 days ago saying Texas is passing up $100 billion over the next 10 years of the implementation of this at a cost of about $15 billion to the state. Well, that sounds like that's an easy decision to take the money. But where is the money going to come from? It's going to be borrowed. So by participating in this, we essentially are encouraging an increase in the entitlement borrowing that's going on to, and an even larger debt in the country.
So do Republicans have another vision?
Well, I think at least a lot of my colleagues in Texas, we passed a health care compact bill last session saying we would like to join with other states and get block grants from the federal government and be able to design our own Medicaid program with our own rules. So much as has been discussed earlier, we're prohibited from making changes by the federal bureaucracy. And to say one size fits all for the 50 states, to me, is unrealistic.
This is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today about the fight over expanding Medicaid. Joining us is John Otto, a representative in the Texas House of Representatives and an opponent of expanding Medicaid in the Lone Star State. Representative, my wife is a pediatric intensive care unit doctor in Dallas, and she'll get a child that comes in with severe respiratory difficulties, pneumonia in both lungs. Child has to go on the ventilator, lines have to be put in, all sorts of monitoring devices. The child fights for its life for days. You know, it can go on for weeks before they pull out of it. And aside from the extremely frustrating aspect that this child could have been effectively treated 3 weeks before with antibiotics and we wouldn't have to put him or her through this pediatric intensive care unit hell, it's costing all of us a truckload of money every day, four to five figures. And the reason the child didn't get seen a month before was because his or her parents had no insurance. So what should have been a $50 health care challenge is now a $75,000 problem or more, a lot more sometimes, as you know. And that story makes me want to pull all my hair out.
I've had a similar story with a young lady that had an abscess tooth that antibiotics would have treated, and the mother was actually given the prescription but didn't go fill it, and it ended up in a $20,000 oral surgery.
So my question is, I mean, this kind of thing pops up because people wait, thinking that maybe I'll get better. And most of the time, I think they do get better, but sometimes they don't get better. And when they don't get better, all of us end up paying a lot of money.
That's correct. But, you know, in this discussion of expanding Medicaid, one of the questions I have is where are the providers going to come from? We're losing doctors currently out of the Medicaid system due to the low reimbursement rates, and they're not wanting to participate. If we're going to add in Texas over 1 million new people, where do we get those doctors overnight to provide? I think, you know, one of my concerns is we could end up with rationing of care just by the fact that we don't have enough doctors participating in the system.
I'd like to welcome into the conversation from Washington, Judith Solomon. She's the Vice President for Health Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Judith Solomon, welcome.
Hi, Wade. Thanks for having me.
Well, you've been listening in. I thought I might get your reaction to the conversation that Representative Otto and I have been having.
Sure. I think one thing to sort of start with is put the federal deficit aside. The Affordable Care Act was paid for, so it's offset with savings primarily in other parts of the health system. So then we're really looking at the costs and benefits in Texas, where the lion's share of the funding for the Medicaid expansion would be paid by the federal government. While there would be a cost to the state, I think what's been left out of the conversation so far is the fact that the people we're talking about are getting care. And in Texas, I think that is primarily paid through the hospital districts in the state. And saw a quote from a representative of the Texas Hospital Association that the uncompensated care just for the hospitals cost close to $5 billion a year. So if we're talking about a $1.3 billion, Wade, I think was a figure you used for the cost to Texas through 2017, just looking at the fact that much of the uncompensated care for people who are now insured and would be able to get coverage through Medicaid would be compensated. So there's an offset to that cost. So I think what we think is that the Medicaid expansion is actually a very good deal for states and for the people in the states because of the benefit of the coverage.
Well, I think Representative Otto's concern is a real one. I mean, I see stories in Texas newspapers about how doctors are becoming increasingly frustrated with Medicaid, and they're not going to take any more new patients. They're not going to drop their existing ones. They're not cruel. But are the states prepared to bring in this many more people in the medical system, and do we have the doctors who are willing to participate?
Well, I think, you know, the research out there shows that in some ways some of this is overstated. There are shortages of certain specialists in the program. But again, looking at this, you know, Texas, people are getting care. They're not getting necessarily the best care. They're getting it in safety net hospitals in Texas. The providers are there, and they will continue to be there, and it's just a question that there will be reimbursement and a more orderly system where people can get checkups and so on. Noam mentioned the study last week in the New England Journal and the Oregon study, and both of them show very significant benefits when people with Medicaid are compared to those who don't have it, whether it's a lower chance of dying, more likely to get preventive services, less likely to report large amounts of medical debt. All of that has been shown. So I think the program is not a failure. I think Noam's right. It can be improved. I think the point he was making was very significant about the bulk of the costs in Medicaid going for seniors and people with disabilities and the opportunity to better coordinate their care and improve the overall program. But I don't think it's a failed program, as Governor Perry said.
Representative Otto, I live in Dallas, and my property taxes help pay for Parkland Hospital, which is the big county hospital that takes a lot of indigent patients. And, you know, if I lived in a county outside of Dallas, you know, a much more wealthy county outside of Dallas, I wouldn't have to pay those property taxes. I mean, how is it fair to me that I'm having to pay these property taxes for Parkland Hospital, and people in Collin County won't build a hospital for their residents but ship them to us in Dallas?
And Wade, Texas has basically applied for and received a waiver to break the state up into approximately 20 regional health partnerships. That has already been accomplished, and there is an anchor hospital that's either nonprofit or public that will be the anchor. And what we're trying to do is to better address where people need to be sent so they don't all show up in an emergency room. So we are taking steps. But let me also say that the Congressional Budget Office has already revised their estimate to double the cost of the Affordable Care Act from $900 billion to $1.8 trillion from 2012 to 2022. So to say it's paid for, I still question. Even the CBO says it's not paid for.
Let's take a caller. Francis from Newport, Vermont, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Yes, I'm fine, thank you.
Good. I'm calling because I work in the healthcare system, and I have an opportunity every day to see people who are on the Medicare and the Medicaid, and I agree that everyone should have healthcare, should have access to it. But I see so much abuse of it and so much fraud. It's very discouraging knowing that this money could be better spent. And in that respect, I'd say it's a failed program because there's no checks and balances. There's no way of dealing with this fraud. And until they can find a better way of running the Medicare, Medicaid system, maybe they shouldn't look at expanding it. Fix it first, then expand it. That's my feeling on this matter.
Thank you, Frances. Elizabeth from Melrose, Massachusetts. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Hi, Wade.
Hello.
Yes, saying a program is a failure is, you know, it's hard for me to hear that because I consider myself a Medicaid success story. If I was ill as a child, I would be dead and wouldn't, you know, if I hadn't had Medicaid. I'm sure I'm not the only person in that situation. If you're a parent, it must be really devastating not to be able to get medical care for your children. And I think it's really sad. So when people, you know, say that the program is a failure, I don't know. I'm sitting here feeling like very, very grateful, and also I'm a productive member of society and on a high tax bracket, and I'm very grateful that I have the opportunity to have that health care.
Thank you, Judith. Obviously, there are millions of Americans like Elizabeth out there for whom Medicaid works.
Yes, and I just want to respond to the cost point. So the cost went up because the budget window is different. So the initial score that CBO had was for a shorter period of time when the program would be fully expanded. And then what he is citing is really the cost of the coverage provisions. Separate from that, there are revenue raisers and other cost offsets, whether it's in Medicare and Medicaid, that pay for the coverage provision. So I just didn't want to leave that unanswered. I think the second caller had it, you know, it was good to hear. In terms of the fraud, I think I would say that this administration has had multiple new initiatives to get at any waste in the system. So I would hope that's being addressed in Vermont and every other state.
Representative Otto, outside of the cost issue, is there a moral issue about leaving so many Texans without coverage? You know, it doesn't seem very Texan to me.
Well, when you say without coverage, as you said earlier, we're covering, everybody has access. It's through the emergency room, and that's what's happening, and that's the most expensive way to dispense it. So I'm not saying it, you know, it needs to be fixed, but I'm not sure just throwing, you know, additional money at the Medicaid system is going to be the proper fix.
Well, you know, I think for a long time Americans have felt that we had the best health care in the world. We used to say that. I don't think we say that so much anymore. Is it your perception that the system is broken?
Well, the system is broken in that it cannot sustain itself. In Texas, over the last 6 years, our cost increase in the Medicaid budget only has been on average 12% per year. That's a 6% population growth in the system and a 6% medical cost growth. At that, if that rate continues, and we're talking about expanding the population significantly, that means the cost to the state doubles every 6 years. That's not sustainable. At some point you go off the cliff. So if you're going to say it's fine right now, okay, but I think you've got blinders on as to what's coming in the future.
Judith, any response to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what he has talked about is really not a Medicaid problem. It's a healthcare cost problem. Healthcare costs across the spectrum are growing faster than the economy. Medicaid actually grows at a slower rate than other kinds of coverage, whether it's Medicare or private coverage. But the real work that has to be done is the work to control overall health care costs. Medicaid is a key part of the health care system. So isolating it in that way, I don't think is necessarily proper, but I would agree that we do have to get at the cost of health care more generally.
Let's take a call from Jan from Jay, New York. Jan, hello.
Hello. I have a few points to make. My uncle's on Medicaid. He's in assisted living, and I have concerns every time it's discussed, Medicaid and health care. What's going to happen if his aid is cut, and where would he go, and what would happen to him? The second point is that a lot of the health care right now that the Republicans are against, that Obama has proposed, is very similar to what was proposed by the Republicans during the Newt Gingrich era, so I don't know why the Republicans are against it now. And I wouldn't trust anything state to state. It needs to be over. I don't trust Republicans at this point because they're usually for the insurance companies and the corporations. And I would want some sort of oversight that someone else was mentioning before. And the other point I want to make is that I have insurance, and it's supposedly very good insurance, but a lot of times the deductible is so high that you need to, you have to make a choice whether to go to the hospital or not for a cold or flu, because you can't even, you don't have the copay. So you have to hit your deductible of like $2,000 before you can even, get taken care of.
Thank you, Jan. Representative Otto, many Democrats would have preferred a single-payer program like what exists in Britain or Germany or Canada, and the inclusion of insurance companies into the health care program was seen as a compromise with Republicans who, in the end, didn't like what was decided upon. What about this distrust?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm not at the national level, so I will tell you that what's been mentioned by Judith about we've got to find a way to bend the cost curve, and I think the only way you do that is to have people participate and having to make a decision because of the cost. Right now, if something is totally free, you're going to have an overutilization of it. You're going to have fraud and abuse in the system. So until we get the private individual, whether they be on a government-assisted program or in the regular market, until they are involved in the decision, I don't think you ever bend the cost curve.
Judith, Representative Otto wants to make the working poor stakeholders, paying stakeholders in the system. Does he have a point?
Well, I think when you look at what the Affordable Care Act does in addition to Medicaid, you'll see that the contributions, once people are a little bit above the poverty line, are fairly significant, both on the premiums and the cost sharing. I think for the people whose income is below the poverty line, what we've seen is that they don't get care when they're charged premiums and copayments. It's as simple as that. The competing needs that they have, they just can't afford it. And again, I would just return to the key fact, and I think one of the callers just mentioned it about the relative and assisted living, is that when you really look at the Medicaid program and who's getting the bulk of the care, while most of the beneficiaries, about half, are children, two-thirds of the spending is on the seniors and people with disabilities, including a great deal of care in long-term services and supports, whether in nursing homes or in the community through home health and other services. So I think we really have to look at it in that way and deal with, at least on the Medicaid side, appropriate utilization in other ways, whether it's through patient education and through care coordination and providers. It's very clear from research that's been done that charging people copayments at those very low rates, we're talking about, a family with, less than $20,000 a year in income, is going to be, just mean that they don't get the care they need.
John Otto, Texas State Representative, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you.
I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking about expanding the Medicaid rolls. We're joined by Judith Solomon, Vice President for Healthcare Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Michael Tanner is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington, where he specializes in healthcare policy. Michael Tanner, thanks for joining us today. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be with you today.
Well, you've been listening in on what we've been talking about so far, and I'd invite you to weigh in.
Well, I think it largely depends on the state whether or not this is a good deal for them to expand their Medicaid program. But for many states, it is going to be very costly. It is not just the new eligibles under the health care law that they're going to have to pay at least part of the cost for. Initially, the federal government will pick up 100% of the cost for new eligibles, but that does decline to 90% by 2022. And, we can say, well, states only have to pay 10%, but 10% of a very big number is a very big number. And if your state budget is pinched, it could leave you deciding whether or not you're going to expand Medicaid or lay off a few more teachers. But it's beyond simply the new eligibles. There's a great deal of worry that you're going to get what's called the woodwork effect, in which people who are currently eligible for Medicaid will start signing up because of all the new discussion, all the new outreach, all the new publicity. And these people who were previously eligible will have to be paid for under the old formula, in which states had to pay 40 or 45% of the cost. So that could be an even bigger burden to the states. And we think that states like Florida or even Kansas could face as much as $20 billion in new costs over the next 10 years. A state like New York could face as much as $53 billion in new costs.
Do they save any money, though, in costs that go away?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt that some of the uncompensated care costs that they are currently facing would now be paid for under Medicaid. And that's why some states, like, say, California, would actually come out ahead in the new formula. They say it varies from state to state. But some of the people who would go on Medicaid are people who are currently insured through private insurance. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has studied this repeatedly and found there's a great deal of this sort of crowd-out effect in which people who have low-wage jobs or who are work for small businesses are often pushed off of private insurance into Medicaid once they become Medicaid eligible.
Judith, would you like to respond to that worry?
Yeah, so I think on the people who are already eligible, a couple things. I think it's important to recognize that the conversation, the equation has really changed on that. With the Supreme Court decision upholding the Affordable Care Act, the factors that are going to bring already eligible people into the program are still in place, and that's going to happen in states, maybe not to the same extent if they expand Medicaid, but certainly to a large extent. There still will be the individual responsibility requirement, the notion that everyone has to get coverage that was upheld, so people will respond to that. They will also respond to the outreach and publicity around the new opportunities for coverage. People won't know what they're eligible for and may be discovered eligible for Medicaid. And there's also a lot of work being done to simplify the eligibility systems so that it's easier to apply and enroll using electronic data rather than, you know, a lot of paperwork. So all those things are going to take place in every state. So even in a state that doesn't expand Medicaid, they are going to see some of the costs from the people that are already eligible. In terms of the other factor that Michael mentioned, the crowd out, the notion that people will drop coverage. The research that's been done shows that it's a relatively small number of people. We're talking about very low-income people who don't have coverage at work for the most part. Most of those people who are already eligible for the program that will come in are people who are now uninsured. So, and when you look at kind of the increase in the gains in coverage, primarily the vast majority of people who will enroll in Medicaid were people who were previously uninsured, whether it's the newly eligible or the people that are already eligible.
Michael, millions of people will be covered under the new law. Is my assumption that it's better to have people covered than uncovered mistaken?
Well, no, it's better to have insurance than to not have insurance. Whether or not that is the best bang for your buck in providing health care, or for that matter, in making people healthy, that's open to dispute. In fact, if you had one marginal dollar to spend, I would not spend it on health insurance. I think there are many more ways to provide for a healthy population with the very few marginal dollars that are available.
Like what?
The problem with this mandated expansion of Medicaid is it makes that decision for the states, decides that for them, the best way to make their population healthier is to spend that dollar on Medicaid. I'm not sure that that's always the answer.
And what would you spend the dollar on?
Well, for example, it might be a better solution to simply create free clinics in rural areas or inner cities that where doctors were on staff and they provided free care coming in. That's different than simply providing Medicaid coverage. It might be better to provide educational campaigns dealing, if you only had a marginal dollar to spend, that deals with things like smoking cessation or getting people better diets or things of that nature. Might be a better use of the marginal dollar if your goal ultimately is a healthier population at the end of the day rather than simply talking about how many people have insurance coverage.
Let's go to John from Waterbury, Connecticut. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Hi, Wade.
Hello.
The point was brought up before, and it needs to be brought up again, that health care begins with doctors. And you can talk about all the budgets and the money you want, but if you don't have doctors to take care of patients, you're nowhere. And the problem now is, and has been for years, is that physicians get paid a fraction of a normal fee, or even a normal fee that Medicare pays, which is terrible. But it's a small fee and it's below cost. And in states like Connecticut, if I provide a medicine that costs me, I'll say $1,000 to give, which isn't uncommon, and the patient has Medicare and Medicaid, I have to write off 20% of that. So it costs me money. It's money out of pocket. And this is why so many people, so many doctors don't participate with Medicaid. They can be very difficult population to take care of in some cases. They're not great about keeping appointments. They really treat doctors like dirt. And if I may, I had a, when I didn't participate in Medicaid, I dropped it. I had a patient who was really near death, kidney failure, a number of problems. And I took care of him anyway, did three big operations, had him in the hospital for 3 months. And at the end of all that, I wrote to Medicaid, and I said, listen, would you at least pay me the little bit that you would normally pay for all these services? And they said, take a hike.
Then this is the push and pull we get, where we get on one side people saying we've got to bring the cost down of medical care, and you can hear Dr. John from Waterbury say, well, not on my back. Judith, what do we do about this?
Well, I think that is I think you stated it right. I mean, it's on the one hand we're saying, you know, it costs too much, and on the other hand we're saying it pays too little. And clearly we have to find the balance here. I would say that in the Affordable Care Act, at least for the next few years, there is going to be an effort on the primary care side to provide payments to the primary care providers that are at least equal to what doctors in Medicare are paid in the state. So there will be a little boost. But I think that really is the dilemma, is, we've got, you know, the issue of costs. And right now we're in a situation where, except for this boost in primary care, we're operating within the overall budget. I think the patient he talked to again, though, brings us back to this, you know, point that's been made a couple times, which is the sort of core group of patients in Medicaid that are costing a lot of money is the people who are also receiving Medicare payments. About 40% of Medicaid spending is on people who are also receiving Medicare, and Medicaid is filling in the gaps there. So I think we have to always keep our eye on the notion that this is really the core safety net and do what we can to improve it. But I don't think the arguments mean that we should in any way diminish or get rid of it.
Let's take a call from Robert from Marengo, Iowa. Robert, hello.
Hello. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. Thank you. Go right ahead.
Well, I was just calling in. I'm an Ohio resident, and I am currently on Medicare and food stamps, and I'm a truck driver. I just started in the industry a few months ago, and I was eligible for Medicaid and Medicare, so was my wife and my daughter. And now I'm making $600 to $900 a week, and I'm not eligible. I don't want it anymore. You know, I needed it to help me out for a little bit, and now I don't need it. But to call in, you call in, leave them a message at the offices, and they don't call you back. I've sent them my pay stubs, and I'm still receiving food stamps. And I'm just kind of wondering, you know, how many people and how much money are they wasting every month by doing that? Because they only do things by mail.
Thank you. Josh from Boston, Massachusetts. Hello.
Hi, hello. Thanks so much for having me on.
My pleasure.
I sort of have a different view of this. I worked as a on ambulances in California, and I also worked in ambulances here in Boston, and in an emergency room out in California. And when that politician said that people will overutilize the system, he's completely wrong. Nobody wants to go to the emergency room. Nobody wants to sit in line for hours and hours and get health care. What they would like to do is actually have health care to cover their issues when they have the problem, when their kid is sick, when they stub their toe, when they break a leg. And we do not have a system in this country that helps with that. We deal with emergencies. So when I used to pick up patients who said, oh, you know, my issue wasn't that bad 2 weeks ago, but because I didn't have the money, I'm waiting for you, we spent a lot more to take care of that patient. If we had something like they had in Canada or Israel or England, it wouldn't be perfect, but the concept of cradle to grave so we can see those people who have, you know, major diseases, or we can see those people who have alcohol issues, or we can see those people who have, you know, eye problems, and actually take care of them, then we can actually have a good system. What a lot of the people who have called into this program and people who are on the show have said is that, oh, it's so expensive, that doctor in Connecticut, oh, I'm not getting paid, I'm not getting paid. Of course you're not getting paid. He's not getting paid because he's getting the insurance companies and the drug companies are basically owning our system.
Michael, let me ask you about this. He's saying preventative care is cheaper. What about his point?
Yeah, well, 2 points on that. First of all, he talked about the insurance companies and the drug companies, but about 52% of all healthcare spending in this country is done by the government through one of its healthcare programs. So they are the largest payer, and they generally do under reimburse. We talk about the cost shifting that goes on from the uninsured. The cost shifting that goes on out of government programs is as big or bigger. In terms of preventative care, it does a couple of things. Number one is that it makes you healthier. There's no doubt that preventive care is a good thing, and the people who get preventative care are healthier. Whether or not it actually saves money is much more debatable. I think if you look at the academic literature, you find that with some exceptions like smoking cessation and things of that nature, that most preventative care doesn't save money in the long run because it's kind of a shotgun approach. It treats both the healthy and the unhealthy alike. And rather than being sort of narrowly targeted. So it doesn't necessarily save money, it just makes the population at large healthier.
Judith, what about this issue that, you know, if you extend coverage to people who don't have it, then they'll, I don't know, get greedier with it? I know there's been a couple of studies out there about how Medicaid recipients use the system. What do they say?
Well, I think the studies show that, you know, the latest ones that are the, you know, the blind studies comparing people show that they are getting, you know, the needed services, you know, regardless of what the benefits of preventive care. I think what the caller really was talking about, and a couple people have mentioned, is not so much preventive care, but care when a problem first arises. And the notion of not waiting till it escalates into something that is much more costly. So leaving aside the issue of whether preventive care is itself a cost saver, certainly dealing with a problem up front in the doctor's office, in the health clinic, is going to be more cost effective than a hospitalization for that same problem. So I think, you know, and I think in terms of the issue of whether you provide Medicaid, whether you provide health insurance versus just giving people the access to free clinics, I think what we've seen is that when, you know, we talked about Texas and the system of clinics and safety nets, is that people end up, it's more of an emergency rather than a system that deals with problems when they arise. I mean, the Medicaid expansion, when we sort of look at the Affordable Care Act as a whole, was really a key component of an overall approach of providing health insurance to people. And everyone, you know, everyone really, the Medicaid program now for most people is operated through private insurers. Most states have Medicaid managed care plans. The other part of the expansion, the health coverage through the exchange, will be through private insurance. So that's really the system we've set up.
Michael and Judith, let me ask you both the same question. Do you think the states in the end are going to end up taking this money after all? Michael?
Oh, I never underestimate the ability of governors to cave in the face of a little federal bribery. But that said, I do think that, 28 states sued the federal government in order to get the right to opt out of Medicaid. So I think that a lot of them are going to take their time about participating.
Judith, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen, you know, we've seen the governors we've talked about who have, you know, said we're not doing this, and you've seen some pushback in those states, even in those states from legislators and others. And then you've seen a number of Republican governors that have said, I'm gonna study this. Idaho, Georgia, Virginia, they're really going to look at the costs and benefits. The original Medicaid program, the Children's Health Insurance Program, states didn't necessarily come in right at the first opportunity, but over time, you know, they all participated. So I think at the end of the day, we will see probably most states, I would say, certainly the majority of states in 2014, and then many more following in the years after that.
Michael Tanner from the Cato Institute, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Judith Solomon at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Wade Goodwin, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.